great to be back in South Dakota. And what a full room. I'm anxious or excited to see this door open. My first assignment 20 years ago when I got out of graduate school in Lincoln and joined faculty at SDSU, I was based out in Rapid City, was to teach a beef quality assurance session at the Black Hills Stock Show. And it was a room much like this, and it was packed. And the doorway, I mean, the doorways are blocked, so, you know, you as a speaker, you kind of feel trapped up here. And so this is my first gig out of graduate school. I'm a little bit nervous. Really my first introduction to Western South Dakota and their producers. And so I get up here and start talking about beef quality assurance. And this guy in the back raises his hand just right away during my introduction. I said, "Yes, sir," in the back. And he said, if you SOBs from the government would be up there guarding our border rather than down here telling us how to do stuff, we'd all be a lot better off. And I just start to see these heads shaking and, you know, and this. And I am, so I'm looking for a door always. Hopefully we're not going to offend you too bad today. I hope we're going to be able to share some neat information today that'll be helpful. What an exciting business that we get to manage, that we get to operate in and live our lives in and develop our lifestyle. But man, for those of you that are in the heat of it, how frustrating can it be? It is unbelievable. Can you think of another business that year in and year out faces the challenges that we face in the beef business and agriculture in general? It's incredible. I mean, our whole livelihood for a single year, all of our income, is we're watching the skies. What's going to happen? Is it going to rain? Or is it going to snow too much? We're watching now much more than supply and demand fundamentals domestically. We're watching foreign markets and trade situations. We're watching what's going on in eastern South Dakota, and I see your corn is not in, which is affecting our feeder cattle markets, et cetera, et cetera. It's challenging. At best, it's challenging. At worst, you end up in some frustrated standpoint of paralysis, which is where we don't want to be. Now, my youngest son here, this is a few years ago, but he was frustrated because I was yelling at him because I caught him on my pickup with that lighter that charcoal lighter that he had dropped there on the toolbox. I'm talking about real frustration about being in a situation where your business is in jeopardy. And I'm gonna share some very real examples with you today. So I'm going to share some data. I'm going to be very transparent on some of Padlock's data as a way to illustrate the point. So just a little bit about our background so you know the context that I'm coming from. Padlock is a 76-year-old family-owned ranching company. And the business was started somewhat humbly right there north of Sheridan, Wyoming, and it's just grown over time to where we're at today. And it has evolved from really what you'd call a controlling owner type situation to a cousins consortium, and now, you know, I'm hired as a CEO, and I am a non-family member, and so I'm the second, as Lee mentioned, talking about Wayne. Wayne was the first non-family CEO of the business. I'm the second. So we've certainly been, are a business in generational transition. Alan, I appreciate your comments regarding that and the importance of those scenarios where that's taken place. We just elected our first fourth-generation family member to our board of directors. And so that's kind of the stage of the business that we're in. Some slides moving. So really the foundation of the company, what we're built upon, is what we would call our elements of purpose. So this is how the Scott family and our board of directors have defined sustainability for Padlock Ranch. And it starts with people. It's having excellent people in place. It's having healthy natural resources and financial excellence, being profitable, being a positive member of our community, helping to sustain our rural communities, and ultimately for the business to be an emblem for the family that it represents. It's a culmination of those other purposes, and an opportunity for them to be proud of agriculture. And as family members today do not necessarily live there in the Sheridan area, do not necessarily even live in the Billings area, some in California and other places, to share this wonderful story of agriculture that we get to all be a part of. And if we can be one little beacon of light in that, then we have had some success. And we do try to measure success by having some achievements in all of these elements of purpose. On the cow-calf side, we run a fairly extensive cow-calf operation on over 400,000 acres in Sheridan County, Wyoming, and Bighorn County, Montana. Really between the Sheridan, Wyoming, Billings, Montana area is where our operation area is. Cow-calf units, cows graze out a big part of the year, with some exceptions the last few years. For those of you that are from this part of the world and seen the winters that we've had, but fairly extensive, about 2,000 cow units. Each cow unit will have 2 to 3 full-time people that will tend after those year-round. And the neat thing about our business model, as you'll see, and this becomes important as I share data with you, is how we integrate it, is that we have other enterprises that are involved in the operation. So we're integrated from a farming operation. Cow-calf, we do run some yearlings. Most of our yearlings are typically our replacement heifers, although we do some at times combine a yearling operation with a stocker operation by only artificially inseminating our heifers through one round of AI, allowing those that conceive become our replacement heifers. The open cattle then become stockers. It takes real good cost management to make that work. But the farming enterprise becomes an integral part of what we do too, especially from a cost standpoint and a risk management standpoint. Yes, we can grow corn in northern Wyoming. We can't grow it like you can in eastern Nebraska and eastern South Dakota and other places, but we can put up pretty good corn silage. And so our feedlot operation really becomes the hub of our income, where we can take the calves that are grown, that are developed on our range operation, use those farm products produced on our farm, and our primary products that we sell are upgraded market cows and 800-pound yearling cattle. And so as we think about our program and what we're interested in, all the way from genetics to the management decisions that we make, we have to have a systems approach, because we are indeed moving cattle through this integrated system. One thing that I think this computer will not allow me to get moving too fast and stay ahead of you. So I really wrestled with how to approach this. I mean, I could teach a whole class on using data in ranch management. And I may surprise you a little bit, maybe not, but I may surprise you a little bit the approach that I decided to take in going through this. Because I'd say, man, if I had to share something with you guys, and I only got just a few minutes to do it, what are the real high leverage points? I'm not going to hit on 15% of the data that we use, and we can talk about that a little more. But what are some real high leverage areas? And I think one is understanding carrying capacity in our grazing program, and we'll develop these. Cost of production data, production and genetic data. And finally, using that information to make managerial decisions and analytics. From a natural resource standpoint, if you remember outside of people, and Alan, you know, hit on the governance side of things somewhat, or at least from an advisory standpoint, I would normally spend about 20 minutes, you know, at the front of a talk talking about the importance of people. But since the charge is on data, I'm gonna go to this natural resource side. And what our goals are is to have healthy natural resources. You know, we want functional nutrient cycles, healthy soils, and we want diversity of production. But from a standpoint of understanding profitability, stocking rate is really, really important. Stocking rate is very important, and we have to be able to match stocking rate to carrying capacity. So one of the ways that I would look at this is if you think of if you invested in a factory, your profitability is going to going to come from efficient use of that. You've got a large capital investment, much like a ranch. Can you think of a more capital-intensive business than the land that we have to operate on to raise beef cattle in our industry? And so you have this huge investment in the factory. You want it to run. You want to have some throughput through that factory, but not more than it can handle. And unlike steel, we're dealing with a sensitive product here in our rangeland and our soils. So we want to take care of that, and I don't want to diminish the importance of that. But I do want to tell you that understanding when you're making decisions, understanding your carrying capacity and matching your stocking rate has a tremendous influence on profitability. Now, this is just a little bit of data that I pulled off one of our grazing planners. I know many of you that are in operations will probably have other software, your own programs. We build, because our program is so unique, we build a lot of spreadsheets. We have spreadsheets and models for just about everything. But one of the things that you can see is in this planning, you've got a pasture, you've got a particular size group of animals and number of days in a pasture and stock days. But look at this over here, the third from the right, where it says available. Now, where we started with that data was to use NRCS soil maps to look at production potential in those areas to determine what the actual availability was when we start building plants. And then you collect information and you analyze it and you change it to fit your experience. You change it to fit your situation. Certain grazing management practices will yield more carrying capacity, like planned time control grazing, like allowing plants time to rest, et cetera, will increase your carrying capacity. And so we want to be well planned. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me, to think that our business model or our operational model is to stock the ranch to the gills every year to where if there is something goes wrong, we're in a pickle. No, we put some flexibility in there. You have to, based on rainfall and snow amounts in our part of the world. But nonetheless, we have to use what God's given us and hopefully what we're able to improve upon by our management to the fullest to maintain profitability. Margins are tough in this business. And so understanding that, we've got years of records and grazing management records that we can go back and mine that data and look at the pasture level of available stock days. And a couple of years of data is not sufficient because you've got all the environmental variability that comes in from year to year. But long-term trends will sure allow you to pin that down so that you can more closely match stocking rate to carrying capacity. Coming with that, though, is understanding what you're doing to the rangeland, some type of a monitoring program. You see, this is in a particular pasture from 2003. Data has been collected through over the years, and here's the same exact spot measured by GPS in 2016. What are we looking at? We're looking at diversity of species. We're looking at bare ground, number of annuals, etc. So, point is, you want to be fully stocked, but you don't want this range resource degrading. We want it improving, maintaining or improving while we're doing that. It takes information. Now, I'm going to admit to you from a grazing, this isn't a grazing conference, but this business is all about putting systems together. And so grazing fits into all of these discussions that we have on anything from genetics to economics or whatever the topic is. All of these things are interrelated. And we've got to make sure that we're taking care of things. But I'll be the first to admit to you that this range monitoring on a large scale is very, very difficult. And it's something that we've struggled with. And so we're looking at newer technologies currently to collect data using satellite imagery, et cetera, to give us better indications of what rangeland health is doing. Those of you that are scientists in the room understand the number of transects you have to have in a particular pasture just to get around the variability that is from zone to zone in that pasture. Well, think about that on the ranch scale. It is very laborious. And so as we think about data collection, we always have to be looking, too, about what are the efficient ways to collect that data. And we'll circle back to that point at some point here, too. But in the range side, we cannot forget about water. And one of the things that we've seen, and well, our part of the world is dry. Some operators don't operate in that. But that's our first limiting nutrient typically. So in our particular environment, we see fairly high return on investment in water development. But we also, because we understand that water is limiting our ability to fully utilize the forage capacity of the ranch. So that I just wanted to mention that as an important point. And then the management of that involves allowing pastures and these plants time to rest. And that's from what, there's all kinds of grazing systems that can allow that. For us, we use a planned time control grazing, but it's data collection and evaluation that allows us to see the effectiveness of that. And one of the things that we've been able to document over time in our operation is because of grazing management and because we've got the data, is we've been able to document a higher carrying capacity on the operation, which, as I said earlier, is important to profitability. Improved carrying capacity, lower cost per unit, more drought tolerance, improved animal performance. Profitability is directly related to how we manage the land resource. And I think you need information to inform you, not only in your planning, but your evaluation of how that's working for you. I'm going to get into I just had to start with that because that is so critical. But I think the greatest risk that we face in our operation is in cost. And so the decisions that we make from an animal selection standpoint, the type of genetics we're putting in our operations to the management systems we're putting in place have tremendous influence on this number. We cannot, as operators, just hope for profitability. And I'm going to show you some examples of how we look at that from a cost standpoint. We have to plan for it, and it needs constant attention for us to maintain profit in this business. Now, as I talk about some of these numbers, I want to make sure we understand the difference in economic and financial analysis. An economic analysis is used in planning. It's looking forward. That's when you might use opportunity cost. We had the opportunity to sell heifer calves versus keeping our own replacements, for instance. But a financial analysis tells you what you did and also what you have to work with. And I want to explain the difference of that because it's really important. And I've been in some of these meetings where people will stand up and they want to go to war over whether you use opportunity cost or actual cost in your calculations. I think they're both important. You just have to understand the difference. And so we'll dive into that a little bit. And you're like, oh my goodness. It's 2:00 in the afternoon and these guys are going to talk about accounting. I am so sorry. So when I took accounting in college, you take theory of accounting, and you got this perception of your head of some guy sitting in a dingy room with a green visor on doing taxes for people, and you're like, I don't want any part of that. Accounting is the backbone of the data that allows us to make decisions on our operation. And if you can take that home today, I hope that's it. If you can take one thing home, it's the importance of having good managerial accounting numbers. And there's different ways to do this, but it's something that I'm very passionate about. We use an accrual enterprise accounting system. We track cost based on type of crop, on cow-calf unit, and everything is booked at cost, so we know what it is. And I'll tell you in a minute why that's important. That means we have what we call a basis established on crop and livestock because we carry those products in our system. Remember, it's a yearling system. So we're calving in May and June and weaning calves in the fall of the year and then carrying cull cows or market cows and yearlings over to the next year. And so at year end, those animals are booked at a particular cost and those crops are booked at a particular cost, meaning that those costs come off the income statement onto the balance sheet as an asset. As you actually sell the animals or feed the crops, it comes back into the income statement as an expense. I think you'll see that developed as we go through this. Don't forget about the importance of depreciation in that cost. Depreciation of livestock and depreciation of equipment. It eats many, many commercial producers alive. And so we have to keep that in focus. So if we look at a box scenario, and those of you that have studied under Dick Whitman or read some of his material, you'll see his influence on some of this from us. But take the box on the top left, cow-calf box. If we do an enterprise accounting of our cow-calf business, the net sum at the end of the day theoretically should be zero, because we're whatever it cost us in that box. So let's say it cost us X dollars to produce these calves. Those are transferred out at cost, so there's no profit or loss, into that box on the top right, which is really our revenue center, which is in retained ownership. Now, your operation may be different, but I think the concept is really important, that those costs track with those animals. The crops that are produced on the second box down on the left, the farm, the net income from the farm, is zero. Okay, that's the financial analysis, because they're transferred at cost into the cow-calf enterprise to feed the cows. That becomes part of their cost, and into the retained ownership side. Then you've got some, you may have some non-consumptive use, like on the bottom left, where you have natural resource income, say from hunting or mining operations or whatever that might be. That's usually a revenue center. Hopefully that's a revenue center. But in our system, and again, all are different, but follow me on the concepts, the profit comes in our system on the retained ownership side. And then you subtract those overheads, those fixed costs that we can't allocate to any of these centers. For instance, my salary, salary of our CFO, baseline cost just to keep the operation afloat. Those are subtracted in the overall sum as you get your net income. Now that, some of you might be like, that's elementary. Others maybe say that's Greek to me. As we go through these numbers, I think hopefully it'll make a little more sense. One thing that we want to track is what our costs are doing over time. And this is a gross number, so it doesn't mean a lot. But one of the things that we're putting a lot of emphasis on in our business is making sure that the operating costs are not on an upward trend. Now, they're going to have environmental noise in them. So if you look back to 2012 to 2018, we've been able to keep our costs fairly flat. That is not by accident. That is very, very intentional management of cost and knowing what those costs are. Okay, now you see we've got a rise in those costs the last couple of years. We've had a couple of really hard winters and a bad fire that were involved in that. And so one of my jobs is to make sure that trend line doesn't continue up at that pace that it has the last 2 years. Or if it does, our business will be in trouble. We look at crop costs. These are tracked from 2008 through 2018. We saw that if you look at hay on the top, the white bar cost to produce a ton of hay, we saw that increasing. We realized the elevation in that trend. Obviously very yield sensitive, right? For those of you that are farmers, it's very yield sensitive, so there's a lot of noise in it. But we had to rethink some things, like throughput through our farm machinery to keep those costs down. And you may look and say, my gosh, Patterson, you had $109 to put up a ton of hay in 2018? Yeah, that's what it cost us. If we want to be real about what it costs you to put up hay, maybe you're cheaper. I hope you are. Maybe the people you work with and advise can do it cheaper. I hope they can. But these numbers that are based on something other than full tracking of costs that go to these crops, I think can lead you to some very erroneous decisions in management. And so you can see the haylage and corn silage, those have some moisture in them, right, because they're silage products. They're lower. But the goal has been to keep those costs somewhat in check. Now, the economic analysis is, do we need to grow corn silage or not? That what's the opportunity of growing corn silage versus some other crop? That's the economic analysis we put on it. Once we've made the decision that we're going to grow corn silage, I don't care what the economic opportunity was for that. Now I care what it actually cost us because I want to be able to track that. Okay, so you can see how the financial and economic go together. Look at cost per calf. Same thing. Since about 2010, we've been able to stabilize those costs. We had an expensive period of time in the mid-2000s, didn't we, when corn got expensive and land got more expensive and lots of things happened. And we, by being able to track that and saying, oh, put on the brakes, we have to know where this is going in making these decisions, we've been able to stabilize that somewhat. The last 2 years, that trend looks ugly, doesn't it? It looks pretty ugly. But what that tells me, that the green line is cost to produce a calf to weaning. The white line is to December 31. So that's their cost. That's the cost that went into the cow while she was pregnant to get the calf, or breeding cost, bull depreciation fits into that, labor, etc. What it cost us to get that calf to weaning, and then the feed it took to get her from weaning to the end of the year. Now, how does this inform me? Well, since that cost has gone up, that cost to get the calf to the end of the year, that says, boy, you better be aware of what that number is when you're building your marketing plan for 2019. It's that 2018 calf crop that's sold in 2019 in our system. Again, the economic analysis is, do you sell calves? Do you have more money in selling calves or making yearlings? We'll do that analysis. But once we've decided to make yearlings out of them, we want to track those costs all the way through. Tremendous management leverage and understanding those numbers and their associated trends. So, from a planning standpoint, I believe using that kind of data, being able to develop an annual operating plan is really critical. That's how we're going to operate things. That's putting a budget to it, developing a marketing plan. But on that operating plan, if it were that simple that you could just write it and walk away, you don't need managers. Our company doesn't need me. Just hire a consultant to help you put that together. You develop it and then you manage it based on reality. And we all know in agriculture, reality does come, and it comes like rolling thunder on right down on your head. And you have to be able to adjust, but you can do it calmly, and you can do it without guessing if you've got good data and good numbers to do it. It also allows us to generate accurate forecasts of what do we project. We do this budget. How are we tracking with budget as we go through the year? So if I've got a unit manager that approaches me, like some of you might in your operation, you may have the idea, well, geez, it'd be really nice to replace that section of fence over there. We tend to struggle with that every year. Is it the right thing to do? Probably so, but how do you know if you can afford to do it right now or not? You've got to know where your budget is, and you got to know where you're forecasting, how you're tracking towards that budget with the changes. Then having good financial numbers over time become really important. So from a budgeting standpoint, we'll build as many spreadsheet models as we can to try to determine to try to model out what we believe is going to happen from a marketing standpoint, from a cost standpoint. If we just don't know, we use averages, long-term averages and data. It's just like in science. The more numbers you have to work with, the more data points you have, the greater N is, the more you can get through variability and come up with somewhat of an accurate number. We model out what we can. If not, we look back at history as what happened and try to put as good of a number on those budget figures as we can. And then we manage for it. So we build a budget with profit in it. We build a budget with profit in it, and we manage to make it work. Financials, we look at long-term trends like return on assets, return on equity, debt to equity, net income, what changes in the balance sheet. And this cost-based managerial accounting helps us track those costs. The financial performance component is critical to sustainability. All the discussion about sustainability, we're really big into conservation. I think it's big. As Lee mentioned, we've been Environmental Stewardship Award winners. It's a huge component of our business. But outside of profit, we're not going to be sustainable. So we have to be intentional about it, ladies and gentlemen. So when we're marketing cattle, I've had some discussion with folks that say, well, don't worry about unit cost of production. That's not really important. What you're really looking at is gross margin. Well, gross margin is important. But if I don't know what cost I have in it, not the opportunity cost back when I could have sold it as a calf and decided not to, I need to know what's going to affect my bottom line. What's going to affect the bottom line of the income statement? That's knowing what that cost is lets us know what our goal is. Our hedging decisions are based on that. If I know that the market, if the feeder cattle board gets to $1.48 and I can hedge in a $10 a hundred profit in doing that, or a $15 a hundred, whatever, heck yeah. And our goals, I'm gonna take that money and put it in the bank. You may be bigger risk takers. Our business is fairly risk adverse that way. And so that number helps us determine that. When do you pull the trigger on forward contracting cattle? When do you know when is the right time? When is the right market? You got to know where your profit point is, or you're guessing. So that this whole idea of this being a good business decision, I think, becomes central to this whole discussion. It is about business, and hoping or guessing is simply not acceptable. We have a lot of unknowns that we have to model out, that we have to estimate. And do we make some guesses? Yes. Swags, right, we call them. But I want to limit that as much as possible. Sustained profitability requires intentional management. Check this one out. This is a cost for us to put a bred heifer into our herd. Look at that trend. Isn't that interesting? So I presented these data in 2013. If you look where that point was, with a group of large ranch managers, and we had a closed-door session. Thank you, Zimpro, for that opportunity to do that. Had a closed-door session with some large ranch managers, and where you can just get in and talk about some of these type of things. And I presented this chart and said, boys, I'm a little bit embarrassed about where this trend is going. And the feedback I got is, yeah, that's what we're seeing too. But understanding that that's where that trend was going allowed us to make some management adjustments and at least stop the bleeding a little bit, right? To understand where we're going to go moving forward. This is a big number. So this is what takes to go from that cow while she's pregnant with that calf, feeding her through the winter, our breeding costs, et cetera, getting the calf to weaning. Weaning to the end of the year, take those crop costs back. What did it cost to get that calf from the end of the year to be a bred heifer booked in our herd getting ready to calve as a two-year-old? That's what those costs represent. Now, the economic analysis, again, do I raise replacements or do I buy them? That's the economic analysis. That's where I put my opportunity cost in. Made the decision to keep her. Now I want to know this so I can accurately calculate depreciation trends. Also used in marketing. Now let me show you a metric that we've been tracking that is the value of cull cow sales. These would be cows leaving our system in the numerator and the cost to put a bred heifer in the denominator. And ideally we would like to keep that at 1-to-1 or greater. Why? It's a leading indicator of profitability by managing depreciation. It is not a direct indicator of profitability. It's a leading indicator. What are we getting in value of animals leaving our system compared to what it's costing us to replace her? That's what it tells you. Now, having the systems in place to capture some of that value, that got pretty lucrative a few years ago, didn't it? You know what we did with that? We paid off all of our debt. Okay, I mean, that having that system in place, and obviously we should track this year somewhere around that 1-to-1. That's the goal, to be that or greater. We may dip under it sometimes, but I think that's a pretty cool metric. Burke Tykert put us onto that a number of years ago. Bill.
I'm curious, on your cull cows, have you tracked any change in age in the cull cows in this over a period of years?
Yes, we have, and I'll touch on that here in just a minute. And maybe not specifically in terms of, I'll talk about how our cows are culled, okay, and the kind of age range that they are. We do have a distribution on that. So if I don't answer your question, come back to me. So we combine that goal of keeping that metric, using our data at a 1-to-1 or greater. We understand what seasonality data is like, right? I mean, we're spring calvers, wean in the fall. We know what utility cow prices are like in the fall. The red line's the 10-year indices. And so where do we sell our cull cows? Well, some of our feed allocation is put into those cull cows. So we're trying to hit this early March market. That's where we're trying to hit. And year in, and it doesn't always work perfectly, but year in and year out, it works pretty good. If you know what it's costing you to get them to that point, okay? That's the other aspect of it. So this year, for instance, our estimated PL on our spring cow sales, bred cows, we sold, it doesn't matter how many we sold, we classed as many of those up as we could by selling them as bred cows. So these, we took our cows that were 8 years and younger, exposed them to bulls beyond our season. They weren't bred to calve in our season, and they went somewhere as a fall calver, a late summer fall calver into another herd. We have repeat buyers on those. It says, okay, a lot of these are young cows. They got behind. I had one guy tell me one time they were PPM cows. He was talking about his PPM cows, and I said, what does that mean? It was a piss poor management. A lot of times our management screwed that up, and they'll make a good cow in somebody else's system. And so we can add, and that $335 a head is with the added feed cost subtracted. Not at the opportunity, but at the actual cost. That analysis does have an opportunity cost in it, and that was the cost to sell them in the fall at a lighter weight, at a lower price per pound. The weigh-up cows, the same thing. They're less lucrative. There's a certain number of these older cows that it depends on the year. Now, in 2015, we could sell 12-year-old cows that were bred like hotcakes. In 2018, nobody wanted those. And so we look at what's the next best thing, and that was to add some weight on them with corn silage and bring them to a different market endpoint. And, of course, your feed resources are a consideration in this. When we build a feed budget, I'm a nerd, okay? I'm a data nerd. But we're not guessing on whether we're going to run out of feed or not. It's modeled in a spreadsheet at the beginning of the year, and I reconcile it every month. It's like you do a checkbook. Because just like any model, there's errors in your model. But every month you get closer to the end, it's more accurate, right? You're modeling less months in front of you. And so we reconcile it. We're not guessing. We know. So with that cost data, I want to move some more into production side of it. How's our system working? Are our genetics the right fit for the system that we're trying to produce in? And then where is our, again, just like in the cost side, where is our management leverage? This is some 2019 data, Bill, that shows this is age distribution in the bars of cows in our system. And the yellow line is their pregnancy rate in 2018. And so pretty informative. And so all of our cows have an electronic identification chip in their ear. They're EID'd when we run them through. We only handle them one time a year. Now, there are going to be some of you who say, okay, we're light years ahead of you. I get it. There's some diseconomies of scale in larger operations that we have that have to be accounted for, too, just in logistics, and we have to balance it with the added labor to collect extra data. So what it becomes then, and maybe if I can glean anything, if you can glean something out of this, is to say, okay, if a larger operation can do this, you know, maybe those are some baseline things we ought to at least be considering. Is there other data we could be collecting that'd be valuable? You bet. Lee, I'd love to be able to tag every calf to the cow and making those decisions for heifer selection and such. Be able to say, okay, where's our best cows? We'll select our heifers out of that. When we're our whole goal is reducing costs and getting that calf cost down to where we had it, I can't hire enough cowboys to go tag that many calves. You know, when we're calving everything, including heifers, on green grass in large pastures, that's not right. I misspoke. We could do it. I don't think we could profitably do it. Now, Lee may say, well, wait a minute, what are you giving up, or some of the others of you, what are you giving up genetically not knowing that? Well, maybe that's a good place where some genomic testing can help us in some of that selection. Collect data that we can collect at a strategic time. And that's something that we're beginning to look at very seriously to help it enhance those decisions. It's a cost-benefit, right? It always has to come back to a cost-benefit ratio. So what do I learn from this? Well, by knowing the age distribution of the cows, we're not guessing at how many replacement heifers we need to keep. We're thinking a few years out. What's the age distribution of these old cows that are coming at us? How many of those do we got that we anticipate are going to be leaving the system? Why are they leaving the system? Their pregnancy rates are falling markedly, and we're selling open cows. Some of them are getting crippled and old, and we know that by experience and data, kind of what percentage that's going to be. And so, I don't know if that answers your question, but about we're getting 12 or 13 years out of some of these cows, but the distribution it sure goes down. Average age in here, I didn't calculate in this particular data set, it's probably 5.7, something like that. Wish I could boast and say, boy, we got a 7-year average cow age. We don't. We really don't. But that may be something we can trend on. Now, matching stocking rate to carrying capacity. Remember I said everything was interrelated? We'll sell these as short-term cows, as bred cows, if there's a market for them. Unless we have the feed resources to keep them, we'll get another calf out of them. If I can sell them to you as a short-term cow and make money, I should be able to sell them to myself as a short-term cow and make money if we have the feed resources to run them. If we don't, because of this declining pregnancy rate, it sure shows you the first ones you throw your loop at if you're going to cull, or if you get into a drought or you get into a tough situation. Why? Because their net present value is lower. Their production potential is less. Once we've got them bred and it's already the first of the year, if we've got the feed, yeah, there are not many of them are going to rebreed. Well, I mean, 80% of them, quite a few of them will. But nonetheless, I get another calf out of them, more throughput through my feed yard. And then I still have a market cow to add some weight to and sell. See how we kind of try to put those decisions together? I think the other thing that we want to make sure of is that we're really customer focused. And so I'll hit the road at times of the year and go visit customers that have bought our cattle. How are we doing? What could we be doing better? What do the closeouts look like? What is the carcass data back? We retain ownership on some and have pretty intimate data on carcass. The crossbreeding program that we've been using has generated tremendous carcass quality in the cattle. And so we want to make sure when we're making selection decisions that we're maintaining that growth in carcass. I'm not chasing it any longer. We're maintaining it, and then I'm wanting to put a focus on maternal, on cows that will fit our system within that, because we're typically building our own replacement heifers. Okay, so with that said, that becomes the kind of information that we're trying to put together. So if I'm looking at genomic information or EPDs, at least set of bulls or whoever set of bulls, that's we've been able to define our goals, and that maternal side goes back to those long-term trends in weaning rate and pregnancy rate, et cetera. How are we doing? What are we getting for live calves and return cows back into the system as pregnants? All right, we got all this data. Man, do we use it. We use it all the time because this is the kind of reality that hits. In 2012, we had a fire come in. These are, remember, we calve in May and June. We had a fire come in and start a series of small fires that burned together and burned 85,000 acres off of one unit that had 4,500 cows on it. Most of the acres that burned, guess what, was the feed that was in front of the cows that was stockpiled to be in front of them. And so you're left with a situation such as this and asking the question, what do we do now? What do you do with that situation? Literally, you could ride, you could trot up on that ridge and everything you saw around you is black. I cried. I'd never seen anything so devastated. Got up, saw it in the air from the airplane, is even worse. But I tell you what, we had the information and we sit down and we did some strategic planning. And one of the things that came to mind at that point was in 2012 was that the cow market was pretty good. Selling bred cows was pretty good. Not where it was going to go, but pretty good. But what did we know in 2012? Meat and poultry production was low and dropping. Beef cow numbers, because of widespread drought in the U.S., were declining. Texas was liquidating cows. Oklahoma, New Mexico, Colorado. Cow numbers were going down. The value of the U.S. dollar was fairly low in the world market. Exports were picking up. What would have happened if we would have pushed the easy button and sold off a bunch of our cows in 2012? We would have missed that standpoint, that we would have missed that period of time that we may never see again. Now, could we have been wrong about those predictions? Yeah, we could have been. That's where you don't ever know for sure, but using the information we had in front of us, we made the decision to take a hit on profitability that year. And we went and leased some more ground, and we bought a bunch of hay, and we fed the cattle, and we held our genetics together. And oh man, did it pay off in 2014, 15, and 16. It was intentional management. It wasn't a guess. There was a little bit of guess in there. So we spend an incredible amount of time in our management staff building spreadsheets, partial budgets, doing these little economic analysis opportunities. We get a number of different opportunities come across our desk, and let's throw the numbers in. Let's analyze it. Having the numbers allows us to do it. One of the things, like I just explained, you know, an example in that is selling is profitable in the short term, but decreases return. It could decrease returns in the long term unless we change the system. So we had to really wrestle with that and kind of pencil it out. So we took a hit in profitability for a year, and really into 2 years, for the sake of long term. So when I talk about managing for profit, don't be short-sighted on that. Best thing to do in that year of that fire would have been for profitability in 2012, been selling cows, put that money in the bank. 2012 would have looked outstanding. Instead, it looked horrid. But it paid itself back with interest. So you ask these questions, you know, can you feed through a drought? It depends. My range friends will tell you, and rightly so, if you're in a prolonged drought and you wait to destock, you're going to have to destock further because of your delay. Those of you that have been in those significant droughts, which we have, understand that. So I'm not saying you never destock, but be careful on pulling those triggers. It depends on feed costs, your current expected market conditions, the duration. Just remember, from a genetic standpoint and from a depreciation standpoint, it's expensive to rebuild the cow herd. It's pretty nice having some fully depreciated cows in the system to sell. So I take those decisions very, very seriously. Those are the ones that can make or break a business. Back to this slide on cost to build bred heifer, giving you examples of how we use some of these data and information we're talking about in management decisions. You see that trend was somewhat mitigated over time. At least we haven't continued to increase in that cost. One of the things that we looked at, for instance, was because of being aware of that data, was range developing heifers. This is a piece of data from 2015. We developed close to 1,100 head out on range, no hay. This is in Montana. Had some in the feedlot, similar number. They were certainly lighter in May, those that we developed on range, but they compensated. They gained over a pound a day more during the summer, those that were range developed. It's like building good stalkers, right? But look, they weighed 840 pounds in our system when we AI'd in July, because we're a May calving system. Okay, plenty big enough to breed. Pregnancy rates in a short breeding season were similar. The feed cost for purchase feed were significantly less for the range-developed heifers. I put a range cost on that and said, boy, in our system, that was, it was cheaper. You may look at that and say, yeah, it's going to cost us a little more for lease and range or rangeland than that. I get it. So do the math. Do the analysis on it. I mean, once you got the numbers, you can put the numbers into a play and see if it works for you. It worked in our system. Then we tracked the cattle. What did it do? What happened after that? So 2015, I just shared those pregnancy rates with you for the feedlot developed in yellow, the range in white. Their second pregnancy in 2016 was identical. Their third pregnancy in 2017 was identical. I haven't mined that this last fall's data out of there, but anticipate it's similar. One of the things we were looking at in 2016 and some strategic planning was some of the land that we lease on the reservation, is leasing costs were going up significantly. And we just said, boy, what's our risk of that? What's going to happen? Like, oh my gosh, rates are going up. Are we heading for doom? So we had the numbers. We modeled it out because we know our cost. We know our performance. We modeled it out on what would a 60% increase in our lease cost do on that particular property to calf cost. A 60% increase in lease cost increased our calf cost by 6.9%. Is it significant? Yeah, it wasn't peanuts, but look where that gross number is. It's still at a level where we can maintain profitability because this is leveraged against some deeded ground that we have. Your situation may be different. We weren't guessing. And then we said, well, what if we it was a particular property that was available to acquire that was near us? Wanted to know, what's that going to do? If we maintain the status quo in 2016, we knew what our calf costs were. If we bought that property as an expansion and paid the interest rate on the note, we were able to calculate what that was. Or we also said, let's look at it as a replacement property, like getting out of those leases that are going up significantly. And looked at it that way. It gave us an idea. Obviously, in an acquisition, there's all other kinds of things like cash flow and real estate appreciation and things you evaluate. But this was an income statement evaluation. What does it do to my P&L? Oh, jiminy. I'm going to just introduce this real quick. This won't take. It's not as bad as you think. Because I just want to show you a concept of using this cost and performance data. This is an example of a capital budget. So if you started with a group of two-year-old cows and just follow it, don't worry about all the numbers, but just follow it from, say, age two to a 13-year-old cow, Bill, if that's going to be some of our older cows. And we started with 100 of those two-year-old cows. And by time, just knowing our production data, what I shared with you earlier, for at least I shared a snapshot of it, we knew with the ones that would fall out, there'd be 7 of them left when they were 13. Of those 100 head. You can see that number down here. You can see the associated pregnancy rates and culling percentages that went along with that. And then I just assumed, this was a model I did for another presentation to look at something. Net present value can be very misleading. I use it for comparison. So I just assumed a stable calf market and that you're selling a 5.5 weight calf in the fall, a stable cull cow market. I started with a cow cost and then appreciated it over time, which hopefully I just said we're waging war not to appreciate it, but just said it would, and then generated a cash flow. Here is cost every year on the number on that set of animals. Here's the revenue from cull cows. Here's the revenue from calves. Here's the amount of cash they generated every year. Then I discounted it to today's dollar because $7,000 13 years from now is not worth $7,000 to me today. This is an economic analysis. I had the opportunity to invest that money and do something totally different with it. So there's a time value to the money. Here's the main point. That's the gist of a capital budget. I just said, what if you, What if you had a system that young cow reproduction wasn't great, but it was in, say, the upper 80s, and you were going to compare it, though, to a system where, and I was trying to look at some industry numbers I'd seen, where young cow pregnancy rates were actually, can tend to be very low, two and three-year-old pregnancy rates. What influence does that have on that capital budget? And what it turned out is the average age per cow in this system, everything else being constant, with an 88% two- and three-year-old breed-up rate, the average age of those cows was 5.6 while they were in your herd versus 5.3 if it was 75. You're like, well, that didn't make that big a difference. Three-tenths of a age, you know, that's not that big a deal. Add up all those cash flows. Check out what it did to net present value. It's a $200 difference. Now, the value is not as important to me because it's dependent on what I put in for those prices and such as it is to illustrate the relationship. And so what this told us and what I was trying to get across in that presentation, you can afford to invest some money in keeping young cows bred. So you're going to wage war on cost? Yeah, but take some of it and put it back into young cows. It's a paying proposition. That's the type. But if you didn't have this kind of data to work with, this is somewhat of a guess. Anyways, it's really a guess and a worthless exercise if you're not using real data. I'm trying to give you some examples of how we use that. This is some data that was actually published from a large ranch in Nebraska that was published in Professional Animal Scientist a number of years ago, looking at net present value of cows on that herd. Well, what did you see? The cows with the highest net present value, that means the highest value to me in today's dollars, based on that future cash flow, was highest for the 4, 5, 6-year-old cows. You know, that intuitively, that didn't make any sense. That's when we buy bred heifers. Aren't they the most valuable to you? No, because in those young cows, you had higher cost of production, lower reproduction, poorer calf marketing, typically, because you're breeding to low birth weight animals sometimes that maybe you're not gleaning as much out of, etc. And then being not as good of a job of marketing the young opens. And I showed you from our data set, that's where even though the pregnancy rate was higher on those young cows, the number of them was highest. The number of 2 and 3 year old cows was the highest because they were the highest number in the herd. So 1% of 2,000 is a big number. So that point I think is really critical and drives home again understanding this where your management leverage is. I think from the other thing that we're moving into, and as I'm closing up here, and I just had to mention it because it's so important, but, you know, to have, it's on the people side. You know, you say, what in the heck does people and data have to do with each other? I think this people deal is really important, and we have to be pretty careful what signals that we're sending in our business to our people to make them as productive and have as much longevity out of them. You know, I was talking to some of the, one of the companies the other day that was talking about being able to calculate, give us a number on stayability from some genomic testing. And I just lost about 2 people. And I said, I just want to test the employees for stayability. I don't really care about the cows. And so we thought, well, we need to focus on that. And so Clay Mathis is here with King Ranch Institute. We have one of his students working with us this summer, and he's helping us put together an employee feedback survey that will hopefully help us to get better and send these right signals. So a type of perpetual data collection that we can do over time to help us with this people side of things. So data can go in a lot of different directions. Just don't forget this, that when you're looking at data, it's not linear. Cause and effect are distant in time and space. Cause and effect are distant in time and space. What I do today is going to affect me somewhere down the road in some area that I didn't expect. So just have that in your mind when you're looking at data. It's not linear. It's not y equals mx plus b. It's not that simple. And the areas of highest leverage are usually not going to be your most obvious. And be careful not to analyze too much. At some point, you've got to make a decision, right? Those of you that are in management, those of you that are like me that like data, you can overdo it. At some point, you got to go with what you got, okay? Without putting it a better way, you got to make a decision, especially around marketing. And there's some things that are very time sensitive. You got to go. Use the best information you can. And collect data to inform your management and your stakeholders. Data collection for the sake of it isn't going to be a praying proposition. We've had situations where we've started down a path of collecting more intense data and then set back after 2 or 3 years and said, did that change a single management decision? That should be your question. Did it change a management decision? Did it inform? If it didn't, you may be wasting your time and money collecting the data. So in conclusion, using data and information, I think, is critical to business success in the areas that we've talked about, from grazing to cost management. Your performance data are influenced by your genetic decisions and management. And then evaluating your system. I think they're really critical. So while our instincts, we'd really, Tyler, rather be out doing this, you better put in your office time. I guess that's my concluding message, and God bless you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. Appreciate it.